going for a trip down memory lane?
Said Jameson impishly. He looked down at her with raised eyebrows. She blushed.
Sorry, I was just trying to lighten the mood. I guess humor doesn't really work with you either.
But Decker had hurried across the lobby to a small flower shop in the corner of the floor. Jameson caught up with him as he approached the counter inside. A woman in her late 40s was behind the counter. She had light brown hair cut short, and her build was blocky. Black slacks and a long-sleeved white blouse constituted her work clothes.
Can I help you?
She asked Decker. This place has been here a long time, Decker began. I remember it. She smiled.
Doris Flores. It's been here ever since the building opened in 1955. My mother was Dora. She started it.
I remember her, too. You look like her. The woman smiled more broadly.
I took over the shop 10 years ago. She and my father had built up a great business. When I was in college, I'd come here and help them. My only job now is not to screw it up. I'm Daisy, by the way. What else would I be named, right? I'm the youngest of 4 girls, and we're all named after flowers.
So you've been here 10 years, Daisy?
Yes.
The woman's brow creased with a frown.
Why do I think you're not interested in purchasing a flower arrangement?
I'm not, Decker said bluntly. He showed her his credentials.
Out of state. Must be important.
It is. There was a research facility in the building. Well, it was here 20 years ago. The Cognitive Research Institute? Daisy smiled.
Oh, sure. I remember them. They were a good customer.
Were? So they're no longer here?
No, they moved out. It was, let me think, oh, probably 7 or 8 years ago. I remember the big trucks out front. As a general rule, most businesses here stay here. It's a great location. Beautiful old building that's been meticulously maintained. Really prime real estate. And it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to Chicago.
I suppose you don't know where they went.
No, I don't. Did you try looking them up in the phone book? Well, I guess online these days.
I did. There was no listing.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
Decker said, thank you anyway. He started to turn away.
But there is old Dr. Rabinowitz.
Decker turned back. Harold Rabinowitz?
Yes. How'd you know his first name?
I did some research before I came, he said quickly.
Oh, well, yes, he's still around. And if you can believe it, he still orders flowers from us. You know, the Coggers, that's what we used to call them. We're some of our best customers. My mother used to tell me fresh flowers every week they ordered. And they sent a lot of flowers to folks, too. It was really nice. Nice for them. Nice for our bottom line.
So you have his address? Her expression changed.
I'm really not supposed to give that sort of information out.
Can you give me his phone number?
I'm really uncomfortable with that, too. You seem nice enough, but it's against our policy.
Decker said, how about you call Dr. Rabinowitz and tell him that Amos Decker would like to see him. If he says it's okay, you can give me his address. If not, no harm done.
Well, I guess that makes sense. So you know him? I saw on your card that you're Amos Decker.
Yes, I know him.
Well, why didn't you say so? Hold on.
She went to a phone, looked up the number on her computer, and punched it in. She turned her back to him as she spoke. A minute later, she put down the phone and came back to them. She wrote something down on a slip of paper and handed it to Decker.
Bingo. He said he would be delighted to see you.
Decker looked down at the paper and then back up at her. Are your parents still alive? Daisy looked mildly surprised at the query.
My mom is at an assisted living center and loving it. Big surprise, she does all their flower arrangements.
Well, tell her that Amos Decker remembers her flowers and they helped a lot.
I sure will. She'll be glad to hear that. The way Mother sees it, the more flowers we have, the better world we'd have.
Outside, Jameson looked at Decker.
Nicely done.
He didn't respond.
So the flowers helped, huh?
He shot her a glance. Yeah, they actually did. So?
So maybe you haven't changed as much as you think.
Chapter 42. On the drive over to Rabinowitz's, Jameson glanced at Decker in the rear of her car.
One question.
Just one?
Maybe not. So, to be straight about this, it wasn't Leopold you dissed. It was his partner, the waitress. Leopold simply delivered the message?
Right.
Presumably because you would have recognized this person?
I'm sure I would have.
And that person was with you at the Institute?
It would be the only reason for the Mallard 2000 reference. I don't believe in coincidences, especially ones that large.
Okay, so our shooter was a male. Well, at least the probabilities lie there. Although the barman very crudely called the person an it. He seemed to think she was a man dressed up as a woman, or maybe a transsexual. Given that sort of radical change, you might not recognize the person.
Maybe not.
And she might have been a man at the Institute and is a woman now, or vice versa.
Could be.
So you dissed that person while you were at the Institute?
Decker's phone buzzed. It was Lancaster. She said,
"We found a lot of usable prints and DNA in the restroom at the bar. We did basic eliminations and then ran them through the perp databases. FBI did the same."
And nothing?
Couple of druggies and a convicted rapist. They're all doing time now, but at some point they use that restroom.
So not our waitress?
No. How goes it on your end?
I'll let you know in a couple hours. Following a lead. He clicked off and settled back in the rear of the Suzuki. Jameson gave him a searching glance.
Nothing?
Nothing. Let's hope Rabinowitz proves more helpful. Dr. Harold Rabinowitz lived in an apartment in an old building on the other side of town. When Decker knocked on the door, he heard footfalls heading his way. A voice said, "Who is it?" "Amos Decker." The door opened and Decker was looking down at a small, balding man with a gray beard and wearing dark glasses. He was well into his 70s. He had on a worn cardigan, dress slacks, and a collared white shirt. "Hello, Amos." The man gazed at Decker's belly. It took Decker a moment to process it. "When did you lose your eyesight, Dr. Rabinowitz?" "Fully? 7 years ago. Macular degeneration, a very nasty disease. You're not alone. I can hear someone else. My friend, Alex Jameson."
"Hello, Dr. Rabinowitz. Please call me Alex."
"I like your perfume. Vanilla and coconut. Very nice. Am I right?"
"You are. Very good."
He smiled, satisfied. "Other senses are heightened to compensate, you know. Please, come in." They settled down in chairs in the small living room. Decker looked around and took in the neat surroundings, the carefully constructed walking paths. He also saw the guide stick for the visually impaired hanging from a peg next to the door.
"I was surprised to hear that you wanted to see me," began Rabinowitz.
"I won't take up too much of your time."
"I've gotten to the point in my life, Amos, where all I have is time. My professional work is done, my wife is deceased, my health is declining, my old friends are dead, my children have their own health problems, my grandchildren are graduating from college and starting their own careers, so your visit is very welcome to me."
Decker settled back and kept his gaze on the man while Jameson shot glances between them. Decker said, "How long have you been gone from the Cognitive Institute?"
"They put me out to pasture 10 years ago. I would have stayed longer, but my eyes were starting to go even then."
"They've moved."
"I know. I keep in touch. The Institute has grown, you know."
"No, I didn't."
"Hence the move. They needed more space. We've come light years since you were with us. We know so much more."
"And you obviously remember me."
"You would be hard to forget, our only professional football player. It was quite unusual. I went into law enforcement when I left here, first as a cop, then a detective. You mentioned that was your ambition when you were here.
Yes, I did.
Good for you. And have you had a productive career?
It's had its ups and downs, like most careers.
Hopefully more ups than downs.
You may be able to help with that.
Rabinowitz frowned.
I don't understand.
Decker mentioned the Mansfield case.
Rabinowitz said, I heard about that, along with the rest of the country. So tragic, so awful. So many lives just ended for no reason.
I'm working that case, and there is a reason. In fact, it might have a personal connection to me.
How so? Rabinowitz said sharply.
I think someone at the Institute, while I was there, is involved with the massacre at the high school.
Rabinowitz gripped the edge of his armchair.
What?
I can't give you specifics, but the killer communicated the old address of the Institute to me. He said that I had dissed him. He indicated that was why he killed all those people.
Oh, my God!
Rabinowitz nearly toppled from his chair, but moving fast for a big man, Decker managed to snag his arm and hold him in his seat. Decker looked at Jameson.
Water?
She jumped up and hurried into the next room. She was back in less than a minute with a glass of water. Decker gave it to Rabinowitz, and he drank down a bit before carefully placing it on the table next to him.
I'm sorry, said Decker. I shouldn't have just dropped that on you. Sometimes I just don't realize.
Rabinowitz wiped his lips with a trembling hand and then settled back in his chair.
Your neurological switches were set awry, Amos, for want of a better term. I know that certain societal parameters and cues are difficult for you, as they were for many of the folks who passed through our doors. It just goes with the territory. Parts of the brain become extraordinary in what they can do, while other parts regress a bit, at least from a societal perspective. It's all a question of priorities for the mind.
That's why I'm here. The folks who passed through your doors, one of them could be our killer.
Rabinowitz shook his head, his brow scrunched up in distress. I find that so very terrible and unlikely.
Damaged minds, Dr. Rabinowitz.
I think you can call me Harold now, Amos. We no longer have a doctor-patient relationship.
Okay, Harold. Damaged minds, even turned exceptional in some ways, are capable of many things, some good, some bad.
But surely you remember quite vividly the people you met at the Institute. Did you see a callous murderer among them?
Honestly, no, and I can't remember ever dissing any of them. I can't recall insulting anyone while I was there.
But you say the man responsible for these terrible acts gave you the address of the Institute.
The old address on Ducton. He did it in code, but it was clearly his intent. Rabinowitz rubbed his mouth.
I'm not sure what I can add to what you already know.
Jameson spoke up.
You focused on patients who were there with you, but what about doctors, psychologists, or other healthcare professionals you met while you were there?
Decker nodded slowly. I hadn't thought about that.
Rabinowitz said firmly, I can't believe anyone who worked at the Institute would ever commit such vile acts.
I don't want to think it either,
said Jameson hurriedly.
But in an investigation like this, you really can't discount any possibility. It would be irresponsible.
Decker said, Chris Sizemore.
Jameson said,
Who?
Rabinowitz said,
He was a psychologist who worked at the Institute. I was told he left there several years ago.
Why do you mention him, Decker?
Asked Jameson. Because he and I did not get along. We had words. Nothing that would have led me to believe he could be our guy, but we didn't get along.
Could he be Leopold 20 years later?
Decker closed his eyes and clicked through the appropriate frames in his head.
Right height and build, facial features similar. But it was hard to tell Leopold's age. Sizemore would be in his early 50s now. Bottom line, while doubtful, I can't be certain that Sizemore and Leopold aren't the same person. The tats on his arm could have come later. He could have lied about being in the Navy. His voice could have changed over the years. A lot of things about him could have changed over two decades. But the police have Leopold's prints and DNA from when he was arrested. Presumably, Sizemore's prints are available in some professional database. It should be fairly straightforward to see if the two are one and the same. He had a photo of Leopold on his phone, but of course he couldn't show it to Rabinowitz to see if it might be Sizemore. He looked at Rabinowitz. Do you know what happened to Sizemore? Why did he leave the Institute? The older man was nervously tapping his fingers against his thigh. As I said, I was gone long before he left. But you also said you keep in touch with former colleagues. Yes, well, he had some professional issues. What sort? I really can't get into that. But I can tell you that they were serious enough for him to be asked to leave. Jameson said,
What sort of problems did you have with him, Decker?
He had his protégés, and I wasn't one of them. Rabinowitz said, Chris did have his favorites. I would like to think that I treated all of our patients with the same level of courtesy, respect, and thoroughness. But I'm also human, and I, of course, would have certain cases that interested me more than others. There are very few blunt force brain trauma cases where the patient actually died before being resuscitated that result in the sort of cognitive rerouting that took place with you, Amos. Rabinowitz paused to smile. And I've been a Bears fan for over 60 years, and though you played for Cleveland, you were the only NFL player to ever come through our door. Now that you mention it, I do remember Chris having issues with that. Whether it was from a genuine dislike of you, or rather from the effects of his personal issues that later led him to leave the Institute, I don't know. But he seemed to think that with you, our priorities were off.
I don't get that. What would he base that on?
Decker answered, Sizemore thought that being a football player, I had accepted the risk of getting my brain destroyed. I guess he thought I was taking up the space of someone who deserved to be there more. Rabinowitz said, Now that, I don't know. That's because I never told anyone. He let that slip during a conversation we had one day in the hallway. That was highly unprofessional of him, said Rabinowitz sharply. Perhaps, but I also never considered that it might be the motivation for what happened at Mansfield.
So the million-dollar question. Where is Dr. Sizemore now?
Rabinowitz said, I don't know. I haven't heard from him since I left the Institute.
Maybe he moved to the Burlington area.
Decker said, If he's still in the profession, he has to be on a database somewhere for licensing purposes. We should start there. I can call the Institute and get whatever information I can, offered Rabinowitz. Since it doesn't involve a patient, I think they would be more forthcoming. Some of them might know where Chris is now. Decker gave him their contact information. We'll be in town for a day or so. Decker rose and said, Thank you, Harold. You've been a big help. Rabinowitz stood too. I pray that Chris is not your man. But if he is, I pray even harder that you will be able to catch him and stop him from harming anyone else. Let's hope that God is listening, said Decker. So you think the person might kill again? Said Rabinowitz. I know he'll try. Chapter 43 After they left Rabinowitz, Jameson and Decker stopped to grab some lunch. While they were at a cafe, Decker called Lancaster and filled her in. She said,
Okay, we'll track down this Sizemore guy if we can. And if his prints are online somewhere, we'll subpoena them and compare them to Leopold's. As soon as we find out anything, I'll call you.
She paused.
So, back at your old stomping grounds. I never knew you were at this Institute place.
No one knew other than Cassie.
We were partners for a long time, Amos.
It never occurred to me that you would be interested in my past, Mary.
Well, that goes to show even people with big brains make mistakes.
She said curtly, her frustration and disappointment evident. She clicked off, and Decker set his phone down next to his plate containing a half-eaten cheeseburger and a small mound of fries.
Everything okay?
Yeah, said Decker, as he picked up a fry.
If it turns out Sizemore is Leopold, he must be one sick dude.
If he killed 13 people, he is one sick dude.
That's not what I mean.
So explain. She slid her plate aside and leaned in.
The diss was you got more attention than some of his proteges? Like it was a beauty pageant for brains? Really? So in retaliation he kills all those people?
Correction. If he is Leopold, he killed no one. Well, we don't know who killed Agent Lafferty, but Leopold was in jail when my family was killed and also when the shootings at Mansfield happened. He has a rock-solid alibi. And it seemed that both incarcerations were planned.
Meaning he knew your family was going to be killed, and he knew the shooter was going to attack Mansfield.
The timing of his coming in to confess to the Burlington police was a little too coincidental. And I checked on the arrest record from Cranston. Disorderly conduct. He spent one night in jail, and that was it. They didn't even bother arraigning him. They just let him go the next morning. But that unequivocally proved he could not have committed the murders of my family.
Right. So he's partnered with someone, our 5'11" skinny dude turned broad-shouldered maniac, to do the actual murdering.
And there is no way that person is Sizemore.
So if Sizemore is the one you dissed, he's partnered with this person who impersonated a waitress at the bar. I wonder who that person is that kills so readily.
I wonder, too.
But still, if Sizemore is behind this, how does someone that effed up become a psychologist?
Something in his mind could have snapped. He could be bipolar, and the meds aren't working anymore. Leopold apparently told his lawyer he was bipolar and had gone off his meds, or at least that's what the PD told the judge. Or he could have had some sort of trauma, either physical or emotional, that changed him. He had a lump on his neck and drug tracks on his arm. Could be a lot of stuff going on inside him. A lot can happen to someone in 20 years. If it is Sizemore, he took a risk in letting me confront him. He knows how my mind works. I don't forget anything. If it is him, I could have recognized him.
But you didn't, so maybe it's not him.
Maybe.
Still also scary.
Of course it's scary, because something like that could happen to any of us.
Or he could be just plain evil.
Or he could be, agreed Decker. Does that make you feel better? She shivered.
I don't think anything about this case could make me feel better.
Decker's phone buzzed. He answered it. Rabinowitz said, Amos, I don't know if this is good or bad news, but the Institute has been forwarding professional mail to Chris since he left. Enough time has passed that it's slowed to a trickle, but they did have an address. Decker wrote it down, thanked Rabinowitz, and then looked up the address on his phone. He said, It's halfway between Chicago and Burlington. We passed it coming up here.
Meaning if he still lives there, he could get to Burlington and back relatively easily.
Let's go.
Decker, shouldn't we call in the police on this?
On what? We have no proof that he's done anything wrong. Not a shred. We can track this down. And if it turns out we're right, we bring in the cops. He walked briskly out the door of the cafe, and she more slowly followed. 4 hours later, they pulled off the highway and spent another 20 minutes on the surface streets before Decker, who was using the GPS on his phone, directed Jameson to a many-decades-old, run-down neighborhood.
The guy looks like he's fallen on hard times,
noted Jameson. Decker remained quiet, but his gaze moved steadily around, taking in everything. That's it. The third on the left with the black shutters. Pull past it.
Jameson drove on, and then Decker had her park at the curb on the opposite side of the street, about a half dozen homes down from Sizemore's.
Decker, Rabinowitz said that Sizemore had left the Institute several years ago.
That's right.
I just thought of this. Could he really be Leopold? I mean, the guy really looked homeless and out of it. Could Sizemore go downhill that fast?
Yes, said Decker. I did. And it didn't take me years. She looked at him open-mouthed for a moment and then slowly turned away before saying,
Oh, okay.
Decker extricated himself from the back of the car and stepped out. When Jameson started to do the same, he ducked his head back in and said, You're staying in the car.
What?
Anything bad goes down, drive away and call the cops.
Decker, I'm not going to let you...
Yes, you are. He closed the car door and set off toward the house. He went down the sidewalk, his hands in his pockets, his head down, seemingly trying to avoid the stiff, chilly breeze. But he kept gazing to the right, observing the house as he went. It was growing dark, but there were no lights on inside, no car in the driveway. Sizemore, if he still lived there, might not be home. He might be in Burlington, planning his next murder. He actually thought it improbable that Sizemore and Leopold were one and the same. Though it had been 20 years, and people could change, Decker felt like he would have recognized the man, even though he hadn't had that much interaction with Sizemore at the Institute. But still, one couldn't be sure without digging further, and right now, it was the only viable lead he had. He crossed the street, stepped between two parked cars, one of which was up on cement blocks, and walked down the crumbling sidewalk. He passed by the house, went around the block, cut through an alley, and ended up behind the house's backyard. He struggled over the sagging chain-link fence and approached the house from the rear. There were no lights visible from here, either. He sidled up to the rear door, slipped one hand over the butt of his gun, and waited, listening intently. No footsteps. No sounds at all. He looked left and right. He saw no one in the backyards of the houses on either side. The night was too chilly for folks to be sitting outside. He put his elbow through the glass, reached through, unlocked the door, and entered. He was now in a small foyer. On his left were a washer and dryer. Up a short set of stairs was the kitchen. The smell of fried foods was in the air, along with the stale stink of cigarette smoke. He remembered that Sizemore had been a smoker. He'd seen him taking his smoke breaks, the pack of cigarettes in his hand, and it appeared the man had never kicked the habit. But Decker had sat in a bar with Leopold, and the man had never lighted up. If you were a smoker, you were going to light up in a bar if you could. And it was legal in Burlington to do so. And Decker hadn't smelled smoke on Leopold's clothes, and he would have. This lead was starting to go sideways, but he had to follow it through. He glided up the steps and looked around the small kitchen. There were some dishes in the sink. A newspaper was in the wastebasket. He checked the date, 2 weeks ago. This was looking more and more squirrely. He left the kitchen and looked into each of the rooms on the main level. There was no evidence that anyone had been here recently. He walked up the short flight of stairs to the upper floor. Then, growing impatient, he raced forward, kicking open doors as he went. He cleared the first room, the second, and then came to the third and last door. He pushed it open and started taking deep breaths, not because he wanted to, but because it was the only way to deaden his sense of smell. He walked over to the bed and looked down. He wasn't sure whose corpse was lying on the sheets, because it was too badly decomposed. The height was about right, but the face was too far gone. From the state of decay, it looked like the body had been here for quite a while. The body had commanded his attention. He had not looked anywhere else. Now he did. His gaze drifted around the room and then held on one spot. He walked over to that wall and stared dumbly at the writing there. Wrong again,
If he's rotted now, it took you long enough. Keep trying. Maybe you'll get there. Or maybe not. XOXO, bro.
Chapter 44. Agent Bogart said, "It's Chris Sizemore. They just confirmed the ID from prints and teeth." Decker had called the police and then the FBI agent. The law had descended on the small, run-down house like a hailstorm. They were in Sizemore's house. Thankfully, the remains had long since been removed. Alexandra Jameson was in her car with strict instructions not to write about a word of this. Decker nodded. "Of course it is."
"Why?"
Decker pointed to the writing on the wall. "Because of that." Bogart stood next to him. "Explain." "They said I was wrong again. This is Sizemore's house. I would only have come here because I thought he was involved. He wasn't. He was just another victim."
"So they're playing you, pulling your chain at every step."
Decker nodded. "Making like they're smarter than I am. And maybe they are."
"Well, let's hope to hell you're wrong about that."
"They've been a step ahead the whole way. If he's rotted now, he was pretty decomposed by the time I figured it out."
"Well, they had a long time to plan this. You might just catch up, the tortoise and the hare. And you have the FBI behind you. It's not like you have to do this alone."
They walked outside. It was now the early hours of the morning.
"So 7-Eleven Ducton," said Bogart. "Your old stomping ground, you said."
"Yes."
"So if it's not Sizemore who had the grudge against you there, who could it be?"
"The other doctors and people working at the Institute had no problem with me that I could recall." Bogart sat down on the concrete stoop and sighed.
"Okay. Anyone else? Because there has to be something. Otherwise, why point you to this place? How else would he even know about it if he wasn't a patient or a staffer there?"
Decker sat next to him. "It's not simply his being there.
There has to be something I did, or that he perceived I did, that would have made him undertake something like this.
To an unbalanced mind, pretty much anything could be deemed to be a slight, Decker. You walked in a door ahead of him. You sneezed on him. You answered a question he wanted to answer.
Who the hell knows?"
"I have to know. I'm the only one who can know."
"Well, you never forget anything, so I have to believe that it'll come to you."
"That's the problem. If it hasn't come to me, then it's not there." Decker tapped the side of his head. "I don't have things come to me. I go inside my head and retrieve them. There's a difference." Bogart rose and looked down at him.
"I guess there is, now that you explain it."
He shoved his hands into his pockets.
"Well, the ME estimates that Sizemore has been dead about 2 weeks. No telling where Leopold and his friend were then. We're going to canvass the neighborhood, see if anything turns up."
"I doubt it will. I slipped in the backyard while it was still light and broke in. And big as I am, no one apparently saw anything."
"Well, we're still going to do it."
"Does Sizemore have a job?"
"We're checking that now. If he did, you'd think someone would have reported him missing when he didn't show up."
"Some jobs don't require you to show up anywhere."
"I'll let you know what we find."
Bogart left him and Decker rose and walked back over to Jameson's car and climbed in. She looked sleepily at him from the driver's seat.
"You could have gone on to a motel," he said. "I'm sure I could have hitched a ride with one of Bogart's guys."
She shook her head and said,
"No, I couldn't have slept anyway. So was it Sizemore?"
"It was. Dead about 2 weeks."
"When you came out of the house before, you said the message on the wall was another taunt?"
"That I had gotten it wrong, but to keep trying. He also implied that maybe I wasn't as smart as I thought, and he called me bro again."
"He's really playing mind games with you."
"Appears to be."
She stretched and yawned.
"So what now?"
"We get some sleep, we both think about things, maybe some ideas will come.
You really think that will happen?
No, I don't. He thought, because things don't come to me, they're already there. Or else, they're not. Chapter 45. They left the next day and began the long drive back to Burlington. Decker hardly spoke at all, and any questions posed to him by Jameson went largely ignored. She finally gave up and turned on the radio. They stopped to eat at a trucker's grill off the highway. Amid a sea of big rigs, Jameson pulled her minnow of a vehicle into an available slot, and they climbed out. Decker was moving stiffly. She noted this.
Sorry about the cramped quarters.
He rubbed his neck, straightened his back until he heard a little pop, and said, I'm hungry. The place was crowded, and they were led to a corner table in the back adjacent to the pool hall, where truckers smacked balls and bet on the outcomes. Next to that was a gift shop, where the most popular items seemed to be lingerie and sex toys for the missus or girlfriend back home. They ordered, and Decker spooned sugar into his coffee while he stared at the laminated tabletop. A Bonnie Raitt song started wafting over the room from a jukebox. Jameson looked around at the beehive of activity, including one man wearing a Stetson who rode an electronic bucking bronco for a few seconds before being pitched off to the delight of his buddies. Decker scratched at his beard and lifted his gaze to her. You need to get on a plane and get as far away from me as you can. You understand that, don't you?
I thought we'd been through this and it was settled. Andy Jackson was...
He was your friend and mentor. And being your friend and mentor, he would not want you to be murdered.
I have my mace and...
They could be here right now, you know, watching us, watching you.
You're just trying to scare me.
I don't have to try to scare you, Jameson. You're a smart woman, which means you're already scared. Their food came, and they ate in silence, each seemingly unwilling to meet the other's gaze. When the check came, Decker paid.
You don't owe me anything.
I ate a lot more than you. Splitting the tab wouldn't be fair. They walked back to the car. Decker, without seeming to, kept vigilant observation of their surroundings.
Where do you want me to drop you?
Asked Jameson, as they drove along the city streets after having reached Burlington.
Your place, the school, the police department? Another life?
Are you going to be getting on that plane? She turned to look at him.
I don't know.
I hear Florida is nice this time of year. Maybe Miami?
I don't like running away from trouble.
This isn't trouble. It's something more than that. It's more about survival.
And what about you? You're staying, right? You're not hopping on some plane and getting the hell out of Dodge.
I'm staying, was all Decker would say. And you can drop me off at my place. She did. As he climbed out of the car, Decker said, Stay or go. Either way, let me know, okay? She nodded, and then drove off. Decker went to his room, took a shower, grabbed some sleep, and then headed back out, taking a crosstown bus to Mansfield. He got off at the corner, looked up at the faded facade of the high school, and trudged inside. Lancaster met him in the library. She looked thinner and paler, and her left hand was trembling so badly she stuck it in her pocket. They sat at the back, and he filled her in on the events of the last 2 days.
So you think Jameson will take your advice?
He shrugged. I hope so. I can't make her leave.
Well, Chris Sizemore was out of town, and look what happened to him.
They can't run everyone down, Mary. This is not some secret organization with unlimited resources. It's two people, capable and methodical, but only two.
That's not a fact. That's speculation on your part, just like my speculation on 7-Eleven.
He considered this and nodded. Actually, you're right. What's happened here? Anything? She shook her head.
We've gotten lip service from the Army. Not that it's likely they could add much. Forensics has been a dead end. We know how the shooter got in, moved around, and left, but that doesn't really lead us where we need to go, Amos.
The only proven point is my connection. It led me to Chicago and the Institute. That lead was confirmed with the murder of Chris Sizemore. The only way they could possibly know about him and the grievance he held against me was if they were there or had some inside knowledge of what went on there 20 years ago.
And you remember nothing that could help us from all the folks who went in and out of that place while you were there?
Decker slumped back in his chair and looked around at the investigators at their various stations poring over details of the case. But he could see in their eyes and movements an ebbing energy, a malaise settling upon them. He had seen cases go sideways like this before. They were coming to believe that they were not going to solve this case, that they were not going to catch whoever had done this. It was draining everyone. He looked back at Lancaster. The only link right now is Leopold, but I know for a fact that he was not at the Institute. The only person he could have been was Sizemore, and even that was a long shot, now disproved.
Well, we've seen that these people can play with physical perceptions. They made a smaller person look massive, and we've had a bolo out on him for a while now and nothing. Guys just vanished.
And no sign of our waitress from the bar?
None. Waitress or waiter, according to the barman.
Physical perception again. The guy impersonated a woman, and he did it well. I was sold on it. And he served me a beer. Was inches from me, and I never suspected anything.
And you're convinced that the waitress or waiter was in on it?
The barman told the FBI that she vanished about 5 minutes before Leopold left and never came back. Could be a coincidence, but I don't think so.
Okay, but it's still not a fact, not yet.
She riffled through some papers.
But I have something here that is a fact.
He sat up. What?
6 students and 3 adults were killed at the school. 5 of the students were male.
And Debbie Watson was the lone female.
But the 5 males were all on the football team. Or 3 were, technically. One was a team manager, and one had gotten kicked off recently for some rule violation.
Decker sat up even straighter. Beth Watson said that Jimmy Schickel was on the team. But I didn't make a connection with the others because of Debbie and the adults.
And Joe Kramer, while the gym teacher, was also the football coach.
And the assistant principal?
Barry Dresden has no connection to the team that I could find. He has no kids at the school, so none of them could be on the team. And then there's Andy Jackson.
But he was killed because he confronted the shooter. It might be that the others were targeted because of their connection to the football team.
But Dresden had no such ties.
But all of the male student victims, plus the coach? That can't be a coincidence, Mary. The odds are way too long. There were lots of targets in each of those classrooms. He had to know who he was shooting. Wait a minute, were the victims all large? Did they look like football players?
2 did. The others were normal-sized, so I doubt he could have picked them solely on their physical appearance. They wear their game jerseys on Fridays before the football game, but the shooting didn't happen on a Friday. But he could have easily found out which ones were on the team, and he could have found their class schedules, too. Or Debbie could have told him, and if so, maybe she knew what he was planning to do.
She paused.
But anyway, I wanted you to know what I had found out.
He looked at her appreciatively. That's good work, Mary. No one else saw that, including me. She smiled wearily.
Well, I'm not used to getting somewhere before you, so it does feel good. But what does it mean, Amos?
I played on the football team here. They took all my trophies. It could be just another way of getting back at me. Another facet of their vendetta. He lapsed into silence.
What?
Dresden, the assistant principal, was targeted. The shooter went to the office to kill him. Debbie and Jackson can be explained away, but not Dresden. If he has no ties to the football team, then why was he killed?
You mean the reason might not be you're playing football here, despite their taking the trophies?
Yes. But if not that, what?
I have no idea.
Well, it won't do us any good beating our heads against the wall on it until we find out more. But we do have some place to go.
Go? Go where?
the bar.
You thirsty?
Yeah, but not for a beer.
Chapter 46. A snowflake drifted down as Decker stood across the street from the bar, Lancaster at his side. The flake hit the sidewalk and then melted almost immediately. Lancaster pulled out a handkerchief and blew her nose.
If you don't want to go in, can we wait in the car at least? It's freezing and I feel the flu coming on.
Decker had taken in the city block grid by grid, and then his gaze started over and went through it again. He began to walk, and Lancaster hurried after him. They covered both sides of the street for a block in either direction. No cameras, he noted.
Burlington has surveillance cameras, just not everywhere. I hear that London and New York have them on every street, but we don't have their tax base, do we?
There are private surveillance cameras, said Decker. Banks, pawn shops, liquor stores, but none that I can see. Can you check on that? See if there are any on this block?
I'll put in a call.
She did so while Decker continued to look around. A few more flakes were falling, and overhead the clouds were thickened with moisture. If the temperature continued to fall, they might get some real accumulation. Lancaster put her phone away.
They'll get back to me. Now what?
Decker headed across the street to the bar, and she followed. It was full, with most tables occupied by couples, although there seemed to be a bachelor party going on in the back of the room. Lancaster eyed with disdain the stripper, who was in the process of shedding her skin-tight Catwoman costume.
Amazes me what gets young men excited.
It's the same thing that's always gotten them excited, said Decker absently. Pretty women in the process of taking off their clothes. He worked his way to the bar and eyed the barman, the same guy he had talked to before. The man came over.
What's your poison? He asked.
I'll take a Miller on draft. Decker looked at Lancaster.
I'm officially on duty,
she said in a low voice.
And a Virgin Mary for my friend, said Decker.
When the man went off to fill this order, Decker turned around on his stool, leaned against the bar, and took in the room. Lancaster did the same.
So Leopold led you to this bar where his partner was allegedly masquerading as a waitress. You guys talked, and then, with the alleged aid of his alleged partner, he vanished.
Allegedly, yes, said Decker irritably.
How did he know you were going to follow him here?
How could I not? All charges dropped. He knew that I knew the police procedure. Processed out of his cell at central lockup and sent packing. He knew I'd be waiting outside. And if for some reason I wasn't, so what? No skin off his teeth. They'd find another way to lure me in.
So you followed him here. What was his endgame?
Maybe he just wanted to see me again up close. Size me up.
But if we're reading this right, the person that really wanted to see you was the waitress. Maybe the one who was at the Institute with you. The one you insulted somehow.
I'm sure that was part of it, too.
It's a wonder he didn't kill you right then. Or at least try to.
I haven't suffered enough, Mary.
Haven't suffered enough? All these people dead, including your family? The story that Jameson wrote trashing you? Him taunting you the whole time?
Still not enough, Mary. Not for them.
What do they want, Amos? I mean, what else could they possibly want from you?
More, Mary. I just don't know what that is yet. But Decker did know what their real endgame was. They want me.
The barman brought their drinks and said,
Hey, man, you cost me some business the other day. Cops all over the place. Scared away half my customers.
You get paid the same, right?
Said Lancaster bluntly.
Tips, honey, said the barman. I live on my tips.
He put an electronic cigarette to his lips and took a puff.
You think the owners of this place pay an actual living wage? If you do, get your head examined.
Decker said, I'm sure your waitresses rely on their tips, too.
They do. But maybe not the one who skipped out on you. Maybe she has another source of income. Maybe it does.
You sure it was a guy?
Asked Lancaster, watching him closely. The barman eyed her.
What's your interest?
She flashed her badge. He took another electronic puff and said, I used to work as a grip off Broadway. Lot of it's around that world. I can tell guys from girls, although I have to admit this one was really good.
So if it was a guy, why did you let him work?
Asked Lancaster. I don't give a shit if a guy wants to dress up like a chick so long as he can serve the drinks without spilling. All I need is bodies. I don't count penises.
Decker said, according to you, the waitress left before the guy I was talking to did.
Well, I couldn't find her after you left. Had to serve drinks at the tables myself until I got a replacement in. So, yeah, it apparently skipped out.
And you called the temp agency? Asked Decker.
I did. And you were right about that. No record of her. Score one for you.
Decker's gaze drifted down to the man's waist. A key fob poked from the top of his front jeans pocket.
What kind of car do you drive?
The barman looked down in surprise, then back up at Decker.
Why? You need a ride somewhere?
No, just curious.
Nissan Leaf.
That's an all-electric.
I know it is. Great gas mileage since it doesn't run on gas. I just plug it in.
Very quiet, I expect, said Decker.
Too quiet sometimes. I've left it running more times than I can remember. Just walked off with the key in my pocket and the damn thing's still on.
Is that right? Where do you keep it parked?
Alley, outside.
Did you notice on the day I was here that when you went out to the car, it was in a slightly different location? The man thought for a moment and then said,
No, not that I remember. Why?
Because I looked in that alley when I was here that day, and there was no car there.
The hell you say, snapped the barman. His eyes widened surprise. But it was there when I left work.
You always keep the car key on you?
Not always. Sometimes I hang it on a hook over there.
He pointed to a wall behind the bar.
Have to move it sometimes when we're expecting a delivery. Beer truck can barely squeeze in that space, and it's a dead end, so they have to back out. Sometimes I let one of the waitresses move it, if I'm tied up.
Well, I think the waitress in question drove it without your permission.
Decker dropped some dollars on the bar.
Tip included.
He and Lancaster walked out.
Chapter 47. The snow had begun to fall more heavily as Decker stared at the gray Nissan Leaf.
Looks like he's charging it now.
She was staring at a power cable running from a port on the car to an electrical box next to the side door of the bar. Decker didn't look at the cable. He was staring at the walls of the alley.
Over there, he said.
Positioned up high and trained so that it would take in most of the alley was a video surveillance camera. Decker walked over to where the camera was mounted and then down at the door of the business.
Pharmacy, he said. This must be the delivery entrance.
Lot of thefts from pharmacies around here,
said Lancaster, who had come to stand next to him.
Not surprised they have a camera. Logical place to hit it from the rear. That's why the door is barred and locked.
We need to get the footage from this camera, and we need it now.
They hurried around to the front. A clerk was behind the cash register, and there was an off-duty police officer near the entrance. Lancaster flashed her badge at him.
I know you. Donovan, 4th Precinct, right?
Yes, ma'am. What do you need, Detective Lancaster?
She explained, and they walked together over to the cash register, where Donovan conveyed this to the cashier. He said,
I can pull it.
A few minutes later, Lancaster and Decker were walking out of the drugstore with the DVD. They drove straight back to Mansfield, where Lancaster popped the disc into her computer and brought up the images. There was a time stamp, so Decker gave her the date to forward to. She worked the computer's controls until Decker said, Stop it, right there. She did so, and the frame on the screen froze. He said, Now, roll it forward in slow-mo.
Lancaster hit the requisite buttons to accomplish this, and they watched as the waitress exited the bar, opened the door of the Leaf, and climbed in after disconnecting the charging cable. A few moments later, she drove off. 10 minutes later, she drove back up again, got out, reconnected the cable, and re-entered the bar.
But the guy said she didn't come back.
"Just wait a minute," said Decker. The woman came back out a few seconds later, turned, and walked off down the alley. Decker looked at Lancaster. She went back in to hang the keys on the hook. Bar guy probably never even saw her.
Right.
So she picked up Leopold and then dropped him off somewhere. Pretty smart to do it with someone else's car. No plate for us to run.
But we can check the car for her prints. She wasn't wearing gloves.
While Lancaster put in a call, Decker was staring at the screen. When she clicked off, he said, "Okay, run it again, but this time enlarge the image as much as you can." Lancaster did so several times at Decker's request. From where the camera was angled, they were watching from the rear of the car. They could see her slide in the driver's seat and later swing her long legs out to exit. Her short skirt rode up her thighs when she did so. But there was no direct shot on the face.
"She's got great legs. Gotta give her that."
"He does," corrected Decker. "At least, I think it's a guy."
"The barman was right, though."
"About what?"
"He told us he'd seen lots of guys as girls when he worked off Broadway. But he said this one was really good, and she or he is. I mean, those really look like a female's legs."
Decker slowly nodded and then looked back at the image. He ran it through 2 more times before shutting it down. But there was still never a clear image of the person's face.
"So? Any mental breakthroughs?"
Decker shook his head. Only there was something. It seemed to be staring him right in the face, but he just couldn't make it out. Lancaster yawned and stretched, and then looked around at the activity going on in the library.
"I wonder when Bogart will show back up."
"He didn't tell me his travel plans," said Decker. "He came up to where Sizemore lived on a jet. I assumed he'd be returning the same way. He would have beaten me back in any case."
"Well, he hasn't checked in here."
"Probably not the only case he's working."
"Maybe not, but I hope Mansfield takes priority, even with the FBI.
"I wouldn't know," said Decker absently. Lancaster checked her watch.
"It's nearly 11, and I've been at this since 5 this morning. I have to get home. You need a ride? I doubt you should walk. It's starting to really come down out there."
She was staring out the window of the library, where under the lights, the snow was falling rapidly. "Okay, I guess I'm done here for now." They walked to the exit. She said encouragingly,
"We have quite a few leads, Amos. We just have to run them down."
"They aren't leads, Mary. They're mostly fluff that will go nowhere. They've planned well."
"Well, you know what they say about the best laid plans."
"I know the saying. Unfortunately, it's often wrong." They climbed into her car and set off. She glanced at him.
"You seemed like you saw something on the security video."
"I did. I just don't know what."
"How did it feel to go back to that place, the Institute?"
"It didn't. It had moved. I just spoke with one of the people who used to work there."
"Still, a trip down memory lane."
"My whole life is one long memory lane."
"Is it that bad?"
"You ever want to get up from a movie?"
"Sure. Lots of times."
"And if you couldn't turn it off? If you couldn't get up and leave it because it happens to be running inside your head?" She gripped the steering wheel and stared ahead.
"I guess I can see that."
The police radio mounted on the dash crackled. The address of a criminal incident was read out by the dispatcher. Lancaster nearly ran the car off the road before writing it. She stared horror-struck at Decker.
"That's my house!"
she screamed. Chapter 48. Mary Lancaster's house was a modest split-level rancher about 30 years old. Even though Earl Lancaster was in the construction business, the house needed painting, and the roof required repairs, and there was rot in some of the wood. The asphalt driveway was cracked in numerous spots. The inside was in a bit better shape, but the rooms were small and dark, and the air was musty. The dark sky around the home was lit by the rack of lights of the police vehicles. Lancaster screeched her car to the curb, leapt out, flashed her badge at the two officers coming out the front door, and would have bolted past them if they hadn't stopped her. One of them knew her.
"Detective Lancaster!"
She tried to push past him. He grabbed her.
"Wait!" he called out. "I'm trying to tell you!"
The cop struggled with her mightily, because, though she was not big, the woman was completely out of control, enraged, screaming, spitting, and clawing. She was going in there. Then she was snatched from them and held completely off the ground. The cops looked up at Decker, who had her in a bear hug, her arms pinned to her sides. She shrieked,
"Let me go, Amos! I will kill you! I swear to God I will kill you, you son of a bitch! I will kill you!"
She kept ranting and struggling, but he held her tight until she finally fell limp in his arms, her head down, her legs dangling. Exhausted, her breaths came in ragged gasps. The cop looked up at her.
"I was trying to tell you that your family is okay."
"What? Then why the hell are all these people here?"
Decker slowly set her on the ground. The cop said, "Because there was an incident.
I tried calling into dispatch, but I couldn't get through. Where the hell is my family?"
"They've been taken into protective custody."
"What? Why?"
"Captain Miller's orders." At that moment, Miller walked out of the house.
"Captain, what the hell is going on?"
"Earl and Sandy are fine."
"What's the incident?" asked Decker.
"Some things left in the house."
"What things?" asked Decker, his gaze dead on Miller.
"Amos, you might want to sit this one out. That won't be happening unless you have some more officers on the scene."
Decker glanced menacingly at the pair of uniforms who had tried to stop Lancaster.
"All right, then," said Miller. And he led the way inside.
They entered the kitchen. Decker eyed the beer bottles on the table and the overturned chair.
"I thought you said nothing happened,"
cried out Lancaster.
"It's not what it seems to be," said Miller. It's all..." He couldn't finish.
Decker's gut took a jolt as the man struggled to find the words. Miller led them into the adjoining room. On the floor was a body. Well, it wasn't an actual body. It was a life-size, inflatable male mannequin. Someone had colored its head brownish-gray. But Decker's attention was riveted on the streak of red drawn across its neck.
Was that supposed to be Earl?
"I think so," said Miller hesitantly, with a quick glance at Decker. "Sick bastard."
Decker also noted that an X had been drawn over each of the mannequin's eyes. Everyone had seen mannequins before. They were ubiquitous and thus innocuous. But this mannequin, it was the most sinister thing Decker had ever seen. It was like the threes marching in the dark at him. Pale, bloody, staring, silent, lifeless. The symbolism reeked of depravity. Decker looked toward the stairs. And then he looked all around. He had been here several times in the past, but his mind, while obviously registering this fact, had now connected it to another fact. This house was nearly an exact copy of Decker's. Not unusual in working-class cookie-cutter communities, where one builder used the same set of plans in constructing hundreds of houses that were essentially the same structures, but for a different color paint or some minor architectural differences.
"So there's another one of, what, Sandy?"
She put a hand out and snagged the back of a chair to steady herself.
"There's another mannequin up there, yes," said Miller, again nervously eyeing Decker. In Decker's mind, he thought back to when he had bolted upstairs very much like these at his house, the night he had lost everything.
"So there's just one more of of these things in my house?
Decker looked back at the mannequin with the slit throat, and then his gaze settled on Miller. And something in those eyes, coupled with what he had just deduced, made Decker say,
"No. There are two more there."
"Yes," said Miller miserably. "Two more."
"What the hell are you talking about? There's just Earl and Sandy. Wait, is one supposed to be me?"
Decker was already heading for the stairs. The first door they came to was partially open. Decker pushed it all the way open, and they stepped inside. A leg was sticking up on the other side of the bed, just as he knew it would be. He stepped to that side of the bed and looked down. As he knew it would be, this mannequin was a female, dressed in a see-through nightgown. There was a blackened dot drawn in the center of its forehead to represent a bullet being fired into its head. Her eyes, too, had been marked with X's. Miller said to Decker,
"I guess you know where the third victim is."
Lancaster gaped as the truth struck her.
"Oh, my God. That's supposed to be..."
"Cassie," Decker finished for her. Miller put an arm on Decker's shoulder. "Amos, why don't you go back downstairs?"
Decker shook his head.
"No." "Amos, please."
"No."
He bolted down the hall and opened the door to the bathroom. The others